and a very good afternoon to you. It's 12:07. You're tuned to Midday Matters News Review right here on 89.1 FM WBOI. I'm your host, Sean Beter. Glad to be with you on this Monday afternoon. And joining me in the co-pilot seat, it's Bob Kaler from the New Sentinel. Thanks very much for being with us, Bob.
Good to be here. Thanks, Sean.
Today's program, we're going to be talking about the growth of meth, the impact on our communities, and what we can do to stem the problem. And we do want to hear from you today. Do give us a call if you have a question or comment for our panelists. The number, it's 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. Joining us in studio now, we have Jerry Lurch, Executive Director of the Allen County Drug and Alcohol Consortium. Jerry, thanks very much for being with us.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
Also in studio today, we have Sergeant Mike Tolles from the Indiana State Police. He's North Zone Supervisor for the Meth Suppression Section. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
All right. Sergeant, thank you very much for being with us as well.
Thank you. It's my honor.
Let's kind of get a baseline for how big this problem has gotten. And Sergeant Tolles, maybe we can start with you and just talk about how long has this form of amphetamine, methamphetamine, been around, and where did it come from? How did it get to Indiana?
Well, first of all, beginning in the 80s, we started seeing some labs. A lot of them are red pea labs, and I'll get into that later throughout the program. We have three types of labs, the red pea lab, the Nazi birch reduction, and the one pot. Mm-hmm. But in the 1980s, we saw that, late 80s, and as we grew into the 90s, we started seeing an increase. And once the 2000 started, we really saw an increase. We found that the trend started on the West Coast, and once it hit Missouri pretty much gave us the heads up that, hey, methamphetamine, this very stimulant, addictive drug, it's growing at a fast rate. We're finding that on average one cook is teaching another 10 cooks. I mean, so that's compounding itself, and it's going to hit you pretty soon. And when it did, it came in pretty hot and heavy.
And Jerry Lurch, does that sound about right in terms of seeing it? Because you deal with people who are getting treated or trying to get people treatment, is that right?
I work with a variety of agencies, law enforcement, education, health care, and the people that I talk and work with are the ones who are seeing people in treatment.
Right. And now, does that sound about right in terms of hearing about these cases of people coming in to get treated for meth addiction?
I would say until the mid-2000s, our treatment agencies and professionals were not seeing that many cases of meth as a primary drug of choice. Always alcohol, always marijuana, always some other usual illegal drugs, but we were not seeing very much meth here in Allen County and in Fort Wayne, really, until almost the mid-2000s for the treatment side.
Bob Kaler.
How many of the people in treatment come there as court referrals, and how many come there of their own volition?
The first answer is I don't have the data in front of me, but I can tell you that most of the people who are in treatment for meth addiction are there not by their first choice. And whether it's been a court or whether there's been a health trauma that has taken them into the healthcare system,
okay,
but it's usually not there. I need help and I'm going to decide to go today. That usually is not the case.
Hmm. And now, Mike Tolles, you mentioned that there are a number of different ways to produce this drug, and you mentioned the one pot method, which I think is what most people are probably familiar with, seeing it in news headlines. Do all of these methods create basically the same product?
Yes, they do. Your yields will be different. The most productive yield comes from the red pea, but that's the most time consuming, and it's harder to get those precursors needed to manufacture that. We find the one pot is very easy. Within an hour and a half, 2 hours, you can manufacture the quantity desired, probably anywhere from 50 to maybe 76-80% yield from the actual transition from pseudoephedrine to methamphetamine.
And I think one of the big things that we see in stories about this is that it is relatively easy to produce. I mean, it's pseudoephedrine and some household products, basically.
Yes, it is. It's. I have it described to me. It's like making cookies. Even though I don't make cookies from scratch, many people do. There may be different recipes and different variations, but you still the result is you get a cookie. Well, in this particular instance, you're still getting methamphetamine.
Mm-hmm. And as, particularly the one pot method are known to be extraordinarily dangerous.
Yeah, what we're finding due to obviously the containers or vessels they're manufacturing it in, they're plastic. Many times it's a plastic Gatorade bottle, a 2-liter bottle, even a glass bottle. And we're finding that, you know, those are not intended to be pressurized at those extremes, let alone have a volatile flammable solvent in it, as well as lithium metal, which is very incendiary. And what we're finding is we're getting a lot of fires and a lot of injuries.
Hmm. We do want to hear from our listeners today. If you have a question or comment for Jerry Lurch or Sergeant Mike Tolles, give us a call. It's 260-452-1185 or 1-800-471-9264. Jerry Lurch, when we're talking about how this affects people, can you take us through that a little bit? I mean, we were talking before the show started. This drug is incredibly addictive.
It is. And for many citizens, fortunately, they're not in a situation to be very exposed to either the people using or how the drugs are made. And that's really the good news. But there's a lot of documentation, especially by law enforcement, that when an individual begins using meth, very often it's a fatal situation, that within a 2, 3, or 4-year period of time, the individual is probably not living for a variety of reasons. But often when they're arrested multiple times over that time period, you can see physical changes in these individuals, and they lose a significant amount of weight. They have what's called meth mouth that really affects the enamel on their teeth. They'll have crank bites or areas of their skin where their nerves have started to kind of break down, and they will itch at or create essentially these open sore kind of things on them. So the physical changes that an individual goes through are pretty amazing. What we've kind of talked around is that no matter what method the meth is made, it's a toxic process, and the chances for explosion or fire are great. The really sad news, and we do hear about children who are in those homes or children of those individuals who are involved or using meth. And so when the police come in and very carefully work with a lab, and again, they can tell you much more than I, but we do know that the children are removed and every possession they have is removed because of all the toxicity.
And in fact, we've heard stories. I read a story earlier this year from the Indianapolis Star that there are a number of businesses that have sprung up across the state specifically to clean these homes or these rooms where the drug's been made.
Correct. And so when someone purchases real estate, you know, knowing what the history is of that particular property or near it are really important. The other part I might mention about methamphetamine addiction is that the research shows that the recovery rates are really low, less than 10% of individuals. And actually, the data I had seen was about 6%. Will be able to successfully stop using. And so that's why I'm saying it's a fatal addiction for the most part, because the recovery rates are very low for that particular substance.
Wow. Bob Kaler.
How do people actually die from it besides trauma that would be secondary to, you know, a fire or crime or something like that? How does it kill people?
Well, no, they definitely can overdose, and for any illegal drug that's not monitored, no one's ever sure really what all the components are of the substance that someone decides to ingest. And then the dosages can definitely vary. When someone is choosing to use an illegal substance, often they have perhaps used another substance, I'll say perhaps alcohol, that might cloud their decision-making when they actually decide upon a dose for themselves. That can be a problem. The whole aspect of either cooking or making meth is a dangerous one, as we've identified, but any illegal drug dealing is a very dangerous situation. And, you know, there may be violence and crime, and I'll say deaths, that occur what appears to be someone was shot or someone was in a car accident, and the incidence of meth or any other substance can be very high on those kind of deaths as well. The people often, what we find, you've seen in the news that our sheriff has asked for more funds for health care, and that's out there. But one of the issues is that people who are breaking the law or addicted to substances usually don't take care of themselves. So if it's not the substance themselves, often they're very malnutrition, they're in very poor health, and you know, there's a variety of things that can happen in that circumstance.
Looks like we have a caller on the line here. And, of course, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number, it's 260-452-1185. Let's get to line one here. We've got Melissa. Melissa, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Hi, it's Alyssa, actually.
Oh.
The show Breaking Bad is obviously a big mainstream media show right now and focuses on methamphetamine. So, Sergeant Told, I was wondering if that helps or hurts or really makes no difference from law enforcement side, kind of shedding light on how dangerous the drug industry is and having methamphetamine on such a large scale like that.
All right.
Well, obviously, there's no correlation that we can identify between that. Obviously, educating people about how to manufacture, and incidentally, that program, I don't know who consults them on that, but it's very accurate as far as a lot of the processes and what can and cannot happen and the paranoia and et cetera. So, as far as being realistic, unfortunately, that show pretty much is. I mean, obviously, there's more things to add to it to give it the appeal to have viewers. But you look at the internet, you type in the word manufacturing methamphetamine, and I can't imagine the number of hits are. Obviously, you know, we'd prefer those things aren't out there, but obviously, you know, you have the freedom of speech, you have the freedom of press, and it can be used for educational purposes as well. I don't think you can really identify a correlation because no one's holding a gun to anyone's head and saying, hey, ingest this very harmful, very stimulant drug that has a 6% chance of rehab and that will devastate your life one way or another, whether it be someday you develop extreme health issues just because you're taking in these carcinogenic drugs and what have you, and chemicals. So
I've only seen the show once or twice, so don't watch lots of it. But if I understand the storyline, part of this story is that this the star of it essentially was a chemistry teacher. And so a person who had had a, quote, successful, stable life. And earlier before the program, we were talking about a couple of the cases where people who would be employed, who had been successful in their collegiate or other careers, can be at risk with even a single dose. And so I think that is an example of the show to say how volatile the substance is, that it's very addictive, and people from a variety of mainstreams can become involved.
Alyssa, thank you very much for your call, and sorry we missed your name there.
Oh, that's okay. Thank you.
All right. Have a very good day. Of course, we want the rest of our listeners to join in today. 260-452-1185 or 1-800-471-9264. We're going to take a quick break. We'll continue the conversation on meth when we get back. This is Midday Matters.
So I decided to jump out the window in my dream, and as it turns out, in my life.
Mike Birbiglia's Sleepwalk With Me has been a This American Life piece, a one-man show, and now a film which he co-wrote with Ira Glass. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with both. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Follow American Roots this week to the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, as we hang out with some of Philly's finest ambassadors of music and culture, including Bobby Rydell, Questlove of the Roots, and remembering soul man Solomon Burke. Plus music to get you dancing the strand and twisting the night away. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Monday night at 7 on WBOI.
Hi, I'm Julia Meek, and I believe that music is the common denominator world round. So each week on Folk Tales, we track those traits, topics, and seasonal celebrations of our lives through folk worlds far and near, ancient to modern, in the finest of musical traditions. Care to join us for the adventure? Then be sure to tune in Monday night from 11 to midnight for the encore edition of Folk Tales with Julia Meek.
Unemployment remains stubbornly high. For black men, it's even worse. Fernando Payne couldn't find full-time work for more than 3 years.
I'll tell you to get a trade. Been there, done that. When the bottom fell out, I went and got a better education, and I'm still in the same boat.
I'm John Donvan, the Du Bois Institute Forum, When Work Disappears. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
It's 12:22. This is Midday Matters on 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Sean Beter, along with Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. And we're talking today about meth in Northeast Indiana and across the state. We want to hear from you. Do you know somebody who's been impacted by this drug? Do you have a question or comment? Give us a call. It's 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters at nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. We're at Midday Matters. Joining us in studio today, Sergeant Mike Tolles, North Zone Supervisor with the Meth Suppression Section of the Indiana State Police. We also have Jerry Lurch, Executive Director of the Drug and Alcohol Consortium of Allen County. And we were talking a little bit over the break here about the spread of this drug. I mean, and even before the program, we were chatting about how, you know, the things that make Fort Wayne economically important, you know, our you know, placement in the region, our network of roads, also make this kind of a crossroads for drugs and for meth in the Midwest.
Yes, you look at our location, obviously in northern Indiana, our proximity to Michigan, Ohio. We're between Cleveland and Chicago. You know, Detroit's just north of us. So we are definitely a hub for a lot of illicit drugs and activities. You look at the gang activity that's occurring. They have to fund their purpose, if you will, and a lot of times they do that through illegal drug distribution. Now, for me to tell you that these labs that we're dealing with, as far as, you know, we work 1,600 labs or whatever it may be a year, that's 90% of our problem related to meth, no, that's not the case. We're still probably 90% of the meth probably is still imported, coming probably from Mexico.
Wow.
But unfortunately, my folks, the people I'm supervising and many of the other agencies, task force, who have certified meth people, they're spending 99% of their time combating the local mom-and-pop cooks. So how do you combat the importation of methamphetamine? You just don't have the resources or the time.
Wow. And I wanted to talk a little bit, too, about Jerry Lurch. Who is affected by this? Who is it? Can we compartmentalize it into, you know, rich or poor or rural or urban? And this, really, we can open this up to both of you, but Jerry, we'll start with you.
Yeah, one of the things early on when I first heard about meth and was told about it, and as Sergeant Mike talked about, we saw it come from the West Coast, a bit from the South first, and I heard it described initially as, quote, the soccer mom's helper, essentially, to help, you know, pick up the pace and be slim and trim and get a lot done. And so on the West Coast, we were hearing about it being very mainstreamed into a lot of levels of society. And when I talked to treatment people and a variety of law enforcement individuals, and when I talked to our people who lead our school systems, you know, it's clear that anyone who uses meth or any other substance that they're addicted to, it affects their homes and their families, and especially their children. It affects concerned parents who worry and put all kinds of emotional and financial funds into individuals who are truly addicted to these substances. It's every walk of life, and it can be at any age.
And Mike Tolles, we were. I don't know if you can talk about this on the air. We were chatting before the program started about somebody who was a high achiever. once upon a time, who then got into meth and was suddenly in confrontations with police.
Yeah, when I first got introduced to, other than training through the state police, they did a program where they traveled throughout the state and provided training for law enforcement and first responders. My first encounter was a police action shooting involving somebody who had been a successful provider for their family, a father, a husband, worked at a manufacturing facility, was a supervisor, and one day was offered methamphetamine as a pick-me-up. Immediately became hooked. Within 2 years, life ended, you know, as a result of a police action shooting when he was firing upon police and extremely paranoid, showing all the indicators of chronic abuse of methamphetamine.
Wow. It looks like we have a caller on the line. And, of course, we do want to hear from you today. If you have a question or comment for our panelists, number is 260-452-1185. Or you can always call us toll-free at 1-800-471-9264. It looks like we have Dan on the line. Dan, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Good afternoon. I happen to be a DeKalb County's public defender.
Huh.
And I know Jerry from way back when I first started practicing law.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jerry. Hey, interesting show so far. I want to point out that, A, what Jerry's been saying is absolutely correct. But B, I have a lot of firsthand experience with offenders, users of methamphetamine. And one of the consequences that I have seen is that when people get out of jail on a bond, for example, if they're charged with possessing methamphetamine or dealing it, if they are released, they inevitably go back to using methamphetamine right away. So as a defense attorney, part of my job is to try to get my clients out of jail on a reasonable bond if possible, but with the methamphetamine clients, it's almost got to be the opposite of that. In other words, I talk to family members, and there's times when I say, you know, you can bond them out, but the fact is they're probably going to go right back to using. And I've had many, many clients over the years who've been rearrested and rearrested, and every time a person's out on bond and they commit another offense, it's a mandatory consecutive sentence for that offense. So I've had people facing 80 years in prison because they've gone out, been released on a bond, and violated the bond. And the unintended consequence, or the consequence of that, is the cost of incarcerating individuals is amazing. And another note, I can tell if I've got a meth client before I even see the charges because of the number of letters they write me from the jail. In other words, they get picked up, and within hours, they need to get out, and they're writing letters that ramble on for 8-10 pages. It's amazing, but it's just the consequence of the use of that drug.
Wow.
Incredible.
Bob Kaler has a question here.
Yeah, Dan, do you see that being locked up for more than a few days helps some of your clients kick this habit, or...
Not at all.
Is it easy to get it in prison?
It's 6 months at least before I can even reasonably deal with the meth addicts, the true meth addicts.
How much of that is because it's easy to get it in jail or in prison?
Oh, no, I'm not saying they're getting it while in jail or prison. I'm saying after being locked
up, it's just got staying power.
They want out, and their minds have been so affected that logic is out of the question. They just need to get out. It's terribly sad.
It is sad. Our National Institutes of Health, the National Institute for Drug Abuse, conducts research, and I've been very fortunate to see some of the data, and they will do brainwave studies on particularly rats, but it shows the physical changes in the brain that these chemicals cause. And when they were measuring drive, they would compare the drive for these drugs according to a hunger drive or even a sex drive, and the methamphetamine drive for drugs would be 20 times more than any other drive that was on the chart. They also showed brainwave images of people who had worked on their recovery, and it took between 1 to 2 years for their brain to begin to function in a way that allowed them not to have that intensive craving.
My, oh, my.
It's very strong.
Yeah, some counties have drug courts. Allen County's got a terrific drug court. Noble County has a drug court. We don't, unfortunately, in DeKalb County. But the fact is, that might be a good way of attacking the problem. But you have to have the money and the people in place to be able to randomly screen people. And meth is one of those drugs that'll go through your system pretty quickly as well, like cocaine. And so you're not always going to catch people.
And Dan, can I ask you, are you seeing continued growth in cases that are being prosecuted in DeKalb County?
I have a steady stream of customers. I wouldn't say it's growing any further. In fact, just last week, I was in court up there, and the probation department provided me with the printout from the state police as to where my client had been buying Sudafed. He and his girlfriend, so that they're not violating the law, but they're buying enough so that it's likely that I would have to guess, yeah, they're probably still using. But I shared that information with my client who's facing a probation violation. I said, they're on to you. They know. You know, they've got this information. He's going to be violated for testing positive, I think, ultimately. But the fact is, you can build in whatever you can, your systems, to prevent people from buying. Frankly, I thought the drug should have been taken off the market. Myself, I thought it should have been a prescription drug rather than making a system that just creates work for a lot of officers. And now the computerized system, the database, is much better than it was. But when you had officers whose sole purpose it was, or job it was, to sit there and watch who's buying Sudafed, and how often and where they're buying it. It was a lot of people power that was effectively, taking them off the street. Well, the officers off the street.
And let's see, you've described it pretty well there. Let's back up just a little bit, though. I mean, the sure. Sale of Sudafedrin is restricted. That's those drugs are behind the pharmacy counter now, and you do have to provide identification. Is that right?
That's correct.
To make a purchase.
Yeah, you have to provide and you sign, but if you've got three or four or five people buying it, you can still get enough easily to make methamphetamine.
And I see acknowledgement here from Sergeant Mike Tolles. It's not just people going to the counter one by one or going to get their own pseudoephedrine.
No, and obviously when it comes to tracking versus prescription only or taking it off being over-the-counter medication, I pose this. If I'm hitting you over the head and we tell Jerry to count the number of times I hit you over the head versus I can't get to you to hit you, which would you prefer? Okay? So do we want to track the number of grams of pseudoephedrine being purchased by these Smurfs? That's the terminology used on the street. Or do we want to eliminate the problem? Do we want to get rid of these mom-and-pop labs so I can now transition that 99% of the time I'm chasing these local meth cooks to diverting and diversion and doing criminal interdiction on imported drugs? Mm-hmm. These Smurf groups, you talk about restrictions of 7.2 grams within a 30-day period. I find it interesting that the tracking company, and I'm not going to give names and I'm not trying to scold or be mean per se, but they provide the number of blocks sales they provide, but they don't tell you what the number of purchases are in comparison to previous years. I think it's safe to say, at least from talking with these individuals who are Smurfs, that instead of having a group of maybe five to a half a dozen people purchasing the precursors, and the primary precursor needed is pseudoephedrine, we now have groups of 10 to 12. On top of that, we also now have a commodity. We have a form of currency out there now in the black market, and it's pseudoephedrine. Now I have organizations to where there's middlemen involved. They'll find a homeless person or a wino, and they'll say, hey, if you go in and buy pseudoephedrine, I'll give you $25. In turn, he's selling that for $50. And in turn, in some areas, they're getting up to $100 or a gram of methamphetamine for one box of pseudoephedrine. And sadly enough, now we're finding that that's happening in some of the assisted living areas. Is these people are trying to generate some more income, and hey, let's go out and buy a couple boxes of Sudafed. Now I have $50 to $100 extra dollars to spend on whatever it may be that they want to spend it on.
Wow, I think that speaks to how deeply this problem is rooting itself. Dan, we have to let you go here, but thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right.
Thank you.
Have a very good day, and thanks for your insight. And we do want to invite the rest of our listeners to get in touch. If you want to join the conversation today, it's 260-452-1185 or 1-800-471-9264. Going to take a quick break. We'll continue the discussion when we come back, and we do have just a very quick announcement here. WBOI listeners who follow us on HD radio should take note that all three of our HD channels will be shut down this afternoon for maintenance. We expect the interruption of service to last just a few hours and will still be available, of course, at 89.1 FM and via our computer stream as well. So do stay with us and keep listening. This is Midday Matters.
The internet helps singles find dates across town. Some smartphone apps can find dates across a bar or cafe or grocery store. Guys seem to like that a bit more than women do.
It's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of.
The only thing scarier than a random grab bag full of dudes just aggressively messaging you is a random grab bag full of dudes literally around you.
Location-based dating, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered airs weekday afternoons at 4 on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Northeast Indiana Public Radio. I'm Sarah D'Elia with WBOI News. Indiana State Fair officials expect final attendance figures for this year's fair to fall a bit short of their goal. The fair's 17-day run ended Sunday with mild and sunny weather, but hot temperatures on the opening days and some thunderstorms hurt attendance. Attendance was about 800,000 through Saturday, and organizers expected Sunday's crowd would leave the fair near the 875,000-person goal. Last year's stage collapse marred fair drew about 872,000 people, with one day canceled. Fair spokesman Andy Klotz says it does not matter how many great events and deals the fair offers if the weather does not cooperate. The fair set its attendance record of nearly 974,000 in 2009. After a six-game road trip in which they went 3-3, the Fort Wayne Tin Caps returned to Parkview Field Saturday for a four-game series against the Dayton Dragons. WBOI's Doug Gruber has the weekend results.
Saturday night, the Tin Caps came out of the dugout swinging in the first inning. The Tin Caps used five hits, three walks, and a hit batter to score five runs. That was the end of scoring for both teams. Fort Wayne shut out Dayton 5-0. Sunday afternoon, Dayton evened the series with two unearned runs in the first inning, helped by two Fort Wayne errors. Dayton stretched their lead with a three-run seventh. The Tin Caps managed a single run in their seventh, but Dayton tied the series at a game apiece with a 5-1 win. The series continues tonight at 7:05. The Tin Caps have only 15 games remaining in the season, 5 at home, 10 on the road. Their chances of making the postseason playoffs are good. Their closest challenger right now is Lake County. They won yesterday and now are just a game and a half behind the Tin Caps. For WBOI News, I'm Doug Gruber.
With less than 5 months left in office, Governor Mitch Daniels has started to spend some time at Purdue University as he prepares to become its next president. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, Daniels says he's still focused on his current job.
Governor Daniels last week helped welcome Purdue's newest freshman class to campus, and he says he spent time in West Lafayette on his days off as he works to learn the ins and outs of his next job. But Daniels says Purdue's Board of Trustees knows his total focus is on his job as governor.
The balance is entirely on the side of this job. They understood that when they approached me about it, that I would not be available till January.
And Daniel says his administration is not just biding time until the next governor takes over.
Late last year, worked out with every department in state government a set of very specific assignments and objectives to be accomplished this year, and we're just managing to those objectives right now.
Daniel says land acquisition and conservation efforts are examples of concrete goals each state agency and department has been assigned. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
And now back to your host for Midday Matters, Sean Beter.
Good afternoon. It's 20 minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock. This is Midday Matters on 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Sean Beter, along with Bob Kaler. And joining us in studio today, our guests, Jerry Lurch, Executive Director of the Drug and Alcohol Consortium of Allen County. We also have Sergeant Michael Tolles. He's the North Zone Supervisor of the Meth Suppression Section. And we are talking about the growth of meth in Indiana, what we can do to stem the problem, and of course its impact on our communities. And we do want to hear from you today. If you have a question or comment for our panelists in the last 20 minutes of the program here, give us a call. The number, 260-452-1185, or you can always call us toll-free at 1-800-471-9264. Looks like we have a caller on the line here. Let's go to Bill. Bill, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Hello. I have an odd question, I guess. You guys are talking about the cooking method of meth, and I live on a city street, and sometimes there's trash and stuff on the side of the road, and sometimes there's like plastic bottles. I've been kind of leery about like whether or not I should touch them at all in case they were used in the production of meth, and I was wondering like if there's anything I should know about that or anything.
Well, and this does speak to a problem. I mean, if you know, when should residents be suspicious, and what is there a way that they can tell?
Well, many times, obviously these vessels or ammonia reaction vessels are just plastic bottles. They're Gatorade bottles, Powerade bottles, Mountain Dew bottles, what have you, 1 liter, 2 liter. Many times they'll have a pinkish or blue tint liquid in them, a doughy substance or granular substance. The HCL generator, which is a hydrochloric gas generator, oftentimes will have tubing attached to the lid. Those would be indicators. Obviously a chemical smell. Or if it's laying in an area where there's vegetation and the vegetation has already started to die around that would be, in my line of work, a clue. we find that to be very helpful. Obviously, chemical odors. The caller mentioned about wine, or should I touch it or not? Absolutely not. I'm looking at some statistics here. Just last year alone, we had 51 law enforcement injured as a result of meth-related occurrences. Wow. And they know they're the trained ones, right? They're the ones that know not to pick up that bottle. But something as simple as a little bottle laying alongside the road that might just seem harmless, they pick it up, you reactivate the chemicals in it, and it'll give off a vapor or gas, and boom, you've got an exposure.
Mm-hmm. And so when should somebody like Bill turn to law enforcement?
Well, actually, Bill, do you live within the city limits of Fort Wayne?
Yes.
Okay. Actually, Fort Wayne City Police Department was very proactive a few years ago, and they actually have meth lab certified officers on their department. And just by making a call to your local law enforcement agency, they can send an officer out to a certified officer, that is, meth-related, and verify whether it is meth-related items.
Okay.
Okay.
Bill, thanks very much for your question.
Thank you. Right,
and have a very good day. Of course, if you'd like to join the conversation, just about 15 minutes left in the show. It's 260-452-1185. Of course, you can email middaymatters at nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. We are at Midday Matters. And before we go any further, I know we were talking before the show here about you have some statistics here about just kind of how the problem has augmented in these last few years. I think we're among the top five in terms of meth production, or at least being law enforcement catching those producers.
Right. Once again, as I mentioned earlier, or maybe it was off air, Indiana State Police was very proactive back in the late 90s, early 2000s, traveling the state of Indiana, educating law enforcement and first responders on the indicators of what to look for manufacturing, distribution, and usage of methamphetamine. And we found in areas where we did those programs, it wasn't long before we started seeing an increase in numbers of labs and arrests associated with methamphetamine. As we've expanded and grown and increased our education efforts, I find that the more proactive a law enforcement agency is, or the more resources they have to be proactive, we find the numbers go up. Now, also, that may be they're in areas where there's a high usage and distribution and manufacturing of methamphetamine as well. I guess it depends on what resources you have available, and your result.
So I do think we're going to take a quick break here in just a moment. But before we go to the break, I did want to ask, you know, what programs around the state have we seen popping up, including locally in our region here, that are aiming to fight this? And I know I'm thinking specifically of a program down in the Henryville area that you had mentioned that was very effective.
You're setting me up on that, aren't you? you had a caller earlier mention Breaking Bad, the show. Well, the folks down in southern Indiana, the meth suppression folks, the full-time folks, got a task force together, and they called it Breaking Stupid. And as a result of their efforts, they concentrated on Smurf groups and obviously manufacturing groups, and they really slammed it to them pretty hard. Unfortunately, the program, and sadly enough, we had a tornado that hit that area down there, and it's very sad that we had to lose Indiana lives as well as many Hoosiers were affected. But also we had an area that was being impacted by methamphetamine use and distribution and manufacturing. But it was a great success, and that's one of the programs we had. We also had a program called Operation River Tweaker that we did back there. We're going to start some programs like that up north here. Obviously, we're not going to call it those programs, but we do need to concentrate our efforts on Smurf groups.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll finish up the conversation when we get back. And we do want to hear from you today. If you have a question or comment, it's 260-452-1185 or 1-800-471-9264. Stay with us. This is Midday Matters.
So I decided to jump out the window in my dream, and as it turns out, in my life.
Mike Birbiglia's Sleepwalk With Me has been a This American Life piece, a one-man show, and now a film which he co-wrote with Ira Glass. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with both. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
John Lee Anderson describes a Syria fractured across religious lines. Battles rage in city streets. Rebels say it's just a matter of time before the government crumbles. But no one can say for sure what happens if or when that happens. I'm John Donvan. Life inside Syria. John Lee Anderson of The New Yorker joins us. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Indiana Tech Law School, opening in Fort Wayne in fall 2013. Information on admissions and curriculum at www.indianatech.edu/law or 855-TECH-LAW.
Good afternoon. It's 10 minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock. This is Midday Matters on WBOI. We're talking today about meth in Indiana, how it impacts our communities, and what we can do to stem the tide. And we do want to hear from you. The number, 260-452-1185. You can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall. That's facebook.com/middaymatters, or you can always send us a tweet. Joining me in studio, of course, Bob Kaler from the News Sentinel. We have Jerry Lurch, Executive Director of the Drug and Alcohol Consortium of Allen County, and Sergeant Michael Tolles from the Indiana State Police. One of our callers touched on this a bit earlier. We were talking about the logging system that's used for those who buy pseudoephedrine products. But there is a question, though, of the effectiveness of those logs. Is that really are those really effective in you know, lowering the amount of production? And we can start with either of you. Let's go with Jerry Lurch first.
We've talked earlier. Sergeant Tolles talked about the smurfing and the organized groups that are out there. But I know we have talked to many who are validating that the logs are a first-line deterrent for people, I'll just say, who are a little more casually involved with the process. Mm-hmm. And so while I've heard some of our citizens kind of complain about, well, I have to sign for You know, I guess I want to thank all those citizens for making the effort, because it is making a difference with a targeted group of our citizens deciding not to pursue the pseudoephedrin in that manner.
And Mike Tolles, does that square with what you're seeing in your work? That at least there is some deterrence using the log system.
Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that since January 1, when that law went into effect, electronic tracking through MPLEX, we've seen a 5.6% increase in labs. Now, there's many variables that can play into that. I actually think that we would see a higher increase, however, due to other goals and to identify the mission of the Indiana State Police. We've had to pull some of our resources into the reduction of fatal crashes in the state of Indiana. However, other states that have gone with the tracking have seen upward to 200% increase in their meth labs. And that's where I get back to when I said, did you want me to track the number of times I bonk you on top of the head, or do you want it to stop? These people are addicts. These people are desperate. A little inconvenience is not going to deter them. They're stealing identities. They're hiring people on the street to buy the drugs. They're increasing the size of their organization as far as their illicit activities that they're doing.
That seems to me like more than a little convenience, though. I mean, it does take a lot of work to steal IDs to expand an organization, to the extremes that we've seen in some jurisdictions.
Well, some of these people who get in so deep, they're up 2-3 days, sometimes a week at a time. I mean, what better way to utilize your time, I suppose? It takes just a few hours to manufacture methamphetamine. The high at times can last up to 24 hours. Obviously, the more chronic users aren't getting that long of effect. Mm-hmm. Their brain is telling them that this is a great experience. Dopamine levels, when I eat chocolate cake, my dopamine's at 150 level. Meth users are at over 1,000, their brain dopamine levels in their brain. So no matter how deplorable their life is or what they're having to do to manufacture this drug or get the precursors for it, it's just a slight bump in the road for them.
And last chance to get involved in the conversation, the number once again, 260-452-1185, if you'd like to get involved now. Bob Kaler.
Jerry, could you tell us something about the relative popularity of meth compared with marijuana and other drugs?
Mm-hmm. I can. There's some good data, really, of our youth primarily, not only in the state of Indiana, but across the country. The University of Michigan sponsors a study monitoring the future where they collect all the statewide data. And so we also help young people be surveyed ages 6th grade through 12th grade is where we have the most data available. We still know that alcohol is number one. We know tobacco is close. In the past, marijuana and tobacco have been pretty close, but the new up-and-comers, prescription drugs. And the actual meth users, and I will say cocaine and heroin and the hardcore opiate users, is a very tiny percentage of that group. But we know, and it goes back to what's available, and again, I'm talking about youth versus older groups. But we know that alcohol and tobacco remain the gateway drugs. We know that when our youth are not able to get a hold of enough marijuana or enough prescription drugs, that we're now seeing a trend of youth turning towards heroin use, and we're seeing that with adult populations as well. And so it's relative availability, heroin, marijuana, cocaine.
Wow. And it looks like we do have a caller on the line just in the last few moments of the program here. Let's go to Lucinda. Lucinda, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters. Lucinda, are you there?
Hello?
Hi there. You're on the program. Go ahead, please.
From a user's point of view, I started using in 85. I stopped in 2001.
Wow.
I mean, I was as many as 9 days at a time. And I couldn't have done it without God, and I think that's the whole thing that most of these programs trying to get people off is missing. They're not putting God in it. I could do all things through God who strengthens me, and that's the only way that I got off and stayed off. I've been clean since 2001,
Lucinda, many congratulations on that, getting clean. Would you mind telling us, or would you be able to tell us just a little bit about how it's affected, or how it affected your life then?
Oh, man. You know, my son just got out of prison because of the drug use that he was on, because he saw me doing drugs years. My daughter-in-law, her husband right now, is in prison because he was doing drugs. It's just, it doesn't just affect one person of the family that's doing it. It affects the entire family. Hmm. And it's just alcohol, all the other obsessions. There's just nothing as addictive as this. And yes, every once in a while, I told somebody, I think I popped the fat cell because I got that taste again. And it's just amazing that after these many years, I still occasionally get that taste.
Wow. Lucinda, the line is a little bit broken here. We're going to let you go, but thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And again, congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. Have a very good day. And Jerry Lurch, I imagine this story is not unfamiliar.
Correct. It's not unfamiliar. And yeah, it's not unfamiliar. And when she was talking about her children, who apparently are adult children at this point in time, but we get stories similar to that for children who are under the age of 12 or 15, and they're living in homes where parents are totally not functional because they're so absorbed. And not only is the child neglected, they're in very dangerous situations.
Mike Tolles, when you've been with law enforcement approaching these homes, is it often a family situation, or is it more often single manufacturers, single users?
No, I find that, you know, it's like a disease, you know, or a plague, if you will. You know, not just, there's not borders, they're not blocks that are going to be just restricted. It's going to filter over into that. It's going to impact other people's lives, and they're going to become addicts, or there's some way their quality of their life is going to diminish as well. And that's what we're finding. You know, children, since 1995, we've seen an extreme increase in the number of children identified at these labs. That tells me that those children are also in need of services. You know, our arrests are up per lab. Over 79% of the labs we work result in an arrest. The numbers speak for themselves. I mean, this is very impactful. Domestic violence is increasing. Child neglect is increasing. Thefts are increasing. It's the village. Our village is being affected. It's a village problem.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of the program, and we'll have to leave it there. But Jerry Lurch, Sergeant Mike Tolles, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Bob Kaler, thanks to you as well for being with us.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks to our listeners for calling in and for tuning in today. I do want to remind our listeners that those who follow us on HD Radio should take note that all three of our HD streams will be shut down this afternoon for maintenance. We expect the interruption to last just a few hours, and of course you can always follow us here at 89.1 FM or via our online streams. That's NIPR.FM. I'm Sean Beter, and this is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1. This is WBOI Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. The time is 1 o'clock. Fresh air is next.